On this episode of Skeptico.
It seemed 10 years ago when I was talking about how reality is an illusion and everything is ruled by powers and principalities and wickedness in high places, and how paranoia is actually might be a good thing and alienation is something people should accept. That was pretty radical 10 years ago. But I'm finding people are just kind of nodding their heads after they look at their Facebook feeds and the news and saying, you know what? Not so much Miguel, but what he's been promoting, the Gnostic sensibility, the Philip K. Dick world and all that. It's a powerful thing. You have the fourth one, which is completely unique until the Gnostics came around. And that is the one that, no, I am not sharing and I am not in any essence with this God. I am not obedient to this God or the spirits or the demons. I belong beyond the stars. I belong with this eternal source, which is pure supreme information, supreme good. And I can make contact with this God, but the lower gods and the rulers and the spirits and the representatives on earth are all false and they've got us all trapped. When you're an alcoholic, the only way you're going to get better is if you finally stop and say, look, I have dug a hole. I am in a terrible position. And that's going to be my default position every day of my life because I want to fight for something. An alcoholic, he's fighting for sobriety, but the Gnostics were fighting for enlightenment, for spiritual clarity.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptica, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and I think we definitely have today somebody who fills that category of leading thinker, and that would be Miguel Connor, host of Aeon Byte Gnostic Radio, and author of a new book, Other Voices of Gnosticism, which really, as I say in the interview, is kind of a jumping off point into this topic of Gnosticism as a way of understanding how these extended realms of consciousness that I talk about on this show are really constructed. Gnosticism, whether you agree with it or not, at least offers a map of that territory. If you've listened to Skeptico very much, you've heard Miguel on this show before, so there's not a need for a lot more of an introduction. Here's the interview. Today we welcome Miguel Connor to Skeptico. Miguel is the creator of Aeon Byte Gnostic Radio, an entertaining and influential podcast that's become part of this resurging interest in Gnosticism that seems to be seeping deeper and deeper into our collective consciousness. Miguel's also the author of several fine books, including a couple of novels that are probably ripe for a movie deal about now. I don't know, Miguel.
No, I hear you. Keep saying that.
But he's here today to talk mainly about his new book, Other Voices of Gnosticism, which is a follow-up to his acclaimed book, Voices of Gnosticism, published just a few years back. He's a great friend to the show. You've heard me mention his show many times because I think it's really just a top-notch podcast. It's always on my playlist. Miguel, it's great to have you here. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Alex. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
Okay, great. Now, we'll see how you feel at the end. I told you just a minute ago, you know, I am going to have to do a little bit of the Skeptico thing on you because that's just, well, it's what I do, man.
So. Oh, yeah. I hear you, man. I was thinking today is like, God, if Alex doesn't go off on me, then I have failed. I mean, that's my favorite part of the show when you go, you know, what are you doing?
Well, I hope I don't go too far. You know what I really wanted to do? Because the book is terrific, and I really hope people check it out, especially if they're a little bit unsure of the whole Gnosticism thing, and in particular, how Gnosticism is more than just a bunch of very old heretical Christians that were talking about weird stuff. If you kind of see the term popping up a lot and you kind of think, hey, maybe there's something really behind that. One, your show is a terrific way to jump into that, but the book is also a way to kind of springboard your way into it as well. So Other Voices of Gnosticism, people, check it out. Aeon Byte, check out that. But I want to kind of take it a little bit further because when I listen to your show, in reading your book, which is a collection of some of those interviews, I just get the sense of someone who is on a trajectory. The show, what is really great about it to me is that it is a moving thing. It's not like you're talking to, you know, the same group of people. It's like you're changing, you're evolving, you're moving with the guests, moving with the topics in a way that is from this base of Gnosticism, but is really extending beyond that. Do you feel that way? Do you feel like this show is evolving as you evolve?
I would say so. I mean, it's evolving with the guests. It's certainly evolving with the listeners. It's like any endeavor, artistic endeavor. It's a journey of self-discovery. What they say about fiction, all fiction is autobiographical. So I think I'm in a way discovering a lot about myself. I mean, those bombastic interviews that people either hate or love, and the YouTube channels, it's always seems to be a fine line. Those are sort of, my own self-therapy into discovering insights and sharing those insights with the world. And I mean, even Gnostic studies has changed in the last 10 years since I started the show. Culture has changed a lot. I mean, it seemed 10 years ago when I was talking about how reality is an illusion and don't trust any sort of reality you see in front of you, and everything is ruled by powers and principalities and wickedness in high places, and how paranoia is actually might be a good thing and alienation is something people should accept. That was pretty radical 10 years ago. But I'm finding people are just kind of nodding their heads after they look at their Facebook feeds and the news and saying, you know what? Not so much Miguel, but what he's been promoting, the Gnostic sensibility, the Philip K. Dick world and all that. And as we can see in culture, it's just been it's a powerful thing.
Absolutely. And I got to feel like you and your show have been a part of that, you know, maybe a small part of that. We don't know. But I think that, you know, a show like yours has a deeper impact than it might show on the immediate radar, because it is so forward thinking and so edgy in so many different ways that I think it provokes people, and then it pops up in other weird ways, I think.
I don't know about that. I mean, again, I have my show. I enjoy sharing with people and listening to people like you and Gordon and so forth. I think we have our own little alternative podcasting world. You can include Gnostic Me, all those small podcasters, and I enjoy that. But as far as impact, just sharing whatever the listeners want to share with me, that's really all I know. I mean, as you know, it's really all about doing our day jobs and then having enough time to put out one more podcast. If I can just get one more interview and mix it up and put it out once a week, that right there is a huge victory, isn't it?
No, that's beautifully said. It really is. I think that is so true and from the heart. So podcasting has become part of that journey for you, obviously, part of this seeking journey. What was it before that? I mean, when did it really start? Did you feel like you were always kind of this seeker, this kind of outside seeker, really?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, many people who listen to our shows, again, we were people that never fit. We were always in the counterculture. We were always weird kids, as you would. And this seemed like the perfect fit for me. I was just thinking the other day how things change. I mean, I remember, and I'm sure a lot of people are like that. I remember being in my teens and I'm listening to Megadeth and Pink Floyd and Rage Against the Machine. And I'm like, yeah, 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 fight the power, fight the power.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was really just a lot of hot air. I mean, there wasn't really anything behind it. There was no, like, as you say, salvific information or sensibility or action. I mean, there was some activism. But then it's sort of life happens. You get a job, have kids, and you watch the news. You take on a political party. But it was starting Aeon Byte just seemed like a natural thing to do. Again, I didn't have any, you might say, I wanted to discover about the Gnostics, but I didn't have any activist counterculture ideas. But as you said, as I started studying the Gnostics more, as more guests started coming up, as the times change, I said, wow, this really is activism. This really is dangerous information. I mean, that stuff I read about, it is really true. This philosophy that the Gnostics have, is dangerous, and it was radical 2,000 years ago, and it's probably very radical now, and I hope it's useful for people.
That's excellent. That's really interesting, too, that, like you say, very early on in the book, the Mark Twain quote about history not repeating itself, but it rhymes. I think our personal history does that as well in some really strange ways sometimes, in that, you know, we do something and then it echoes with something from the past in a way that goes, wow, you know, that's funny. Right. That's kind of how I was earlier, but now I have a different, deeper way of going about it. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, now you can find the tools and use them.
So, you know, one of the things I thought we might do as a way of introducing people to what's going on with Other Voices of Gnosticism and an Aeon Byte in general is talk about some of the things that you do on the show that I think are kind of interesting in the ways that you're just talking about right there. And the first one that comes to mind, you really dig into some pretty hardcore history. I mean, you have to. I mean, if you're into Gnosticism, you have to. But you really dive into it. You have some top-notch history scholars, biblical scholars, ancient language scholars, and you're not afraid to really get in there and dig into that stuff. Do you feel like that's been important to you? And why is that important? Because history is kind of it's tricky in many ways, particularly the history of the Gnostics, because they were so heretical. They were the heretics, the heretics. So we don't even know in a lot of cases how accurate that history is because it's so prone to be distorted. How does history play into this whole thing for you?
Well, first I'd like to say it's not so hard to dig into the history because a lot of these scholars who do very hard work, they put on a lot of effort. They actually, even if most of them are secular, they, by osmosis, they find themselves walking the walk of the Gnostics, trying to understand them culturally and so forth. So they do have a relationship with these ghosts, if you would. So when asking them the question, they get excited because they really feel that they can express this in a way that they can't express in the classroom or to their peers. So they get excited. In fact, some of my best supporters of the show, some who really like my introductions, are usually these like highfalutin scholars who email and say, "Hey, I love your intro and thanks for everything." So that's an important. And of course, as we both know, all scholars have an agenda. And that's what's interesting because I was at the Mythicist conference, the debate between Robert Price and Bart Ehrman on whether Jesus exists or not. I was the MC, if you would. And Ehrman himself said, look, all scholars have an agenda. All scholars have a viewpoint, and they're going to argue from that viewpoint, and they're going to argue hard. Nothing wrong with it. We're human beings. We're subjective to be from the beginning. So it's impossible to be completely objective. I mean, as you say, if we are completely objective, we'll probably turn into robots. So, but that's the sticky point, right? Because history has to be viewed from a human lens, and the human lens likes immediately to take a perspective. We see something and we see a change. So again, that's a sticky point, and that's something that's ongoing and changing. I mean, Gnosticism studies has sort of changed in the last 10 years. When I started, it was basically the vibe or the trend was say, well, these guys were just alternative Christians. They might have been pro-feminist. They were just kind of part of the stew that was going on. Now it's kind of changed. Now it's swung the pendulum more closer to than it was when the 60s and 70s, when people thought the Gnostics were these radical existentialists, rebellious counterculture. Now it's sort of swinging back, where some of the scholars putting out work are saying, no, these guys were subversive, they were unique, and yes, they had to go because they were just very dangerous to the world, at least to the secular powers and religious powers or ruling whatever empire was around.
Well, you know, the other thread that I hear coming through in your shows, and you just touched on it a little bit, is diversity. So it's even beyond that of saying, oh, were they these heretic kind of wild guys or were they just ordinary Christians? Now what I hear coming through in Aeon Byte is, yeah, there were all those things. There were some that we really have to say were really just kind of Christians, and they had some pretty radical ideas and stuff, but they were more or less Christians. And there's some that were probably not what we'd call Christians, but we're kind of trying to hide under the avoid, you know, being totally outed so that they weren't dragged out and killed, but had some radical ideas. And I think that's reflected in some of the people you're talking to today, some of the modern people. So you have, you know, Richard Carrier comes on your show and he's has some deep biblical knowledge, but is pretty much a hardcore, you know, biological robot kind of atheist right. kind of guy. And then you have people inside the Aeon Byte big tent that are Christian, you know, the progressive mm-hmm. Christians, and are kind of more broadly are able to integrate in some of the Gnostic sensibility stuff. Tell me about that. Tell me about the range of people, and am I getting that right? Is there that diversity?
Oh, there is a diversity. I think one thing to understand is, or two things, and I'm using, again, a lot of the latest scholarship from Dylan Burns and his book, The Apocalypse of the Alien God, and April de Koenig's The Gnostic New Age, some of the newer stuff. One is that there was never a, you might say, a normative Judaism or a normative Christianity. It's like Dylan Burns likes to say, it's more of the Judeo-Christian matrix or stew. It was always there. It was fluid. It was moving around. And it was, and again, it was never normative or in any sense. I mean, there's countries, I think, like Lithuania that didn't become Christian till the 15th century. The Catholic Church was never really centralized until the late Middle Ages. So there was always diversity in Christianity and certainly Judaism. I mean, if you read like Margaret Barker's The Great Angel, Judaism was polytheistic probably in the first century, probably beyond that. And especially with the resurgence of Kabbalah. But to understand the Gnostics, and this is from April de Koenig, you can't really see it as a religion, but as a metaphysical orientation. That's when it begins to make sense, and you can start classifying these groups instead of saying, well, these guys were Christian or this. Because she points out there was four ways of worshiping in the ancient times, or four spiritualities, if you would. You can't really call them religions. One was, okay, I exist and the gods rule me, and that's it. There was a second one, which is sort of the covenant one. I'm going to make a deal with the God, like the Jews and others, and the God will take care of me, and I'll take care of the God. There was the third one, which is the mystical one, which says, the God's going to take care of me, but I get a chance to sort of commune with the God or connect with the God and be one with the God. But at the end of the day, I still have to come back to earth, and the God still rule me. You have the fourth one, which is completely unique until the Gnostics came around. And that is the one that, no, I am not sharing and I am not in any essence with this God. I am not obedient to this God or the spirits or the demons. I belong beyond the stars. I belong with this eternal source, which is pure supreme information, supreme good. And I can make contact with this God, but the lower gods and the rulers and the spirits and the representatives on earth are all false, and they've got us all trapped. So when you see it that way, you see the Gnostics as being very unique, and B, you can start really classifying these groups like the Hermetics, you can the Sethians, the Valentinians, the Cathars, and all that. And of course, they had differences and they had arguments and their view on reality and how negative or positive change. But ultimately, it was all about, I don't belong here. This world is false. I need to touch upon this greater, higher source. And this will transform me, and I'm going to spread this gnosis. So when you see it that way, I feel it becomes a lot clearer to understand the Gnostics and why Gnosticism can be so diverse and have such a big tent, if you would.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the catch-22 of it is that if there is a truth to that, if there is a reality that, then it has to crop up everywhere. And it really, you can't even categorize it into those four, because that spark, as you say, of gnosis has to emerge over and over again, because it is the ultimate truth that's behind the veil. So no matter how you veil it, it comes through. So it's kind of paradoxical.
Yeah, it is very paradoxical, but at least it's a good working model. And again, you can include the Kabbalists, the Sufis, and others. And of course, there's a lot of big overlap. There always will be in religions. It's just the way it is. I mean, Plotinus, in the, what, 4th century, he's complaining about the Gnostics, how crazy they are and how they're making trouble because of social issues and their strange beliefs that go completely against Plato and against the Hellenic model of spirituality. But he shares a lot of the things with the Gnostics, and even the Orthodox Christians in the 1st-2nd century, they believed in gnosis. Irenaeus talks about that the Gnostics had the gnosis, the false gnosis, and he had the right gnosis. He had the right experience with the divine, except his experience would be with Yahweh or Jehovah. Clement of Alexandria always thought any good Christian must have gnosis, must have a divine knowledge. But as time went, when you're trying to make franchises and corporations out of this religion, the idea of a direct contact with the divinity, well, it doesn't work.
And how do you square that with the guests that you have now? Like I was just saying, I mean, you have this diversity of opinions that come onto the show, and you do a nice job of kind of making it fit, but it almost in some ways seems like it wouldn't quite fit with what you're laying out there. I mean, how does a Richard Carrier fit with a progressive Christian?
Well, I mean, it would have to, let's put it this way, of the Gnostics, of course, being from the, they saw themselves from the Platonic worldview, were major myth makers. They believed, like Plato and some of the Greeks, that the myths of Zeus and all that probably weren't real. But they were great stories. They drew upon the world of the unconscious. They were, behind them were powerful archetypes. And this sort of mythology itself was a spiritual exercise, and it was very valuable. It was very sublime and very wonderful. So you have somebody like Richard Carrier, who has a great passion for mythology because he's a scholar of a Greco-Roman religion. So that's the point he liked. And he's, of course, he's a mythicist. And of course, the Gnostics, very few Gnostics thought that Jesus ever came in the flesh. They thought he was real as a force, as a spiritual principle. So then you have that overlay. Again, it's that love of mythology.
But that's a pretty thin overlay, isn't it? I mean, because it's that double talk that really drives me nuts with the atheists. You know, it's like I get the same thing when I talk to neuroscientists about near-death experience, and whenever somebody leads with, oh, it's important to people, and I realize that it's what they're really saying is, people are deluded, they're delusional, but I'm not going to call them on it. And I kind of feel like that's where the atheists are coming at it too, with, you know, I love myths is code speak for stupid people believe weird things.
Oh, yeah. I think in Richard Carrier's case, that might be, but I definitely have to ask him. But then you look at somebody like Robert Price. He's an atheist, but right, he says he is 100% Jungian. He does believe in the collective unconscious. He believes there is this well of information, this well of symbols and archetypes that are very valuable and inspire men to be the best version of himself. So again, it really depends.
Well, he doesn't know it, but he's not an atheist, because you can't really, you can call yourself an atheist, but you're not really
an agnostic atheist, perhaps.
Yeah, along with, and I think that agnostic thing has really got to go too. Bart Ehrman has worn that to death. So, hey, so you, the question that really everyone wants to know, and they should know if they listen to your show, because you say it a bunch, but where do you come down on the historical Jesus question? You hosted the debate won't go away. Where do you come down on it?
Well, I think it's no secret that I am a mythicist. I've been a mythicist since probably before I heard of the Gnostics, back when I was more of a liberal Catholic, and somebody handed me these photocopies of Acharya S.'s The Christ Conspiracy, and it suddenly everything just clicked. But it's certainly not my dogma. To me, again, I think it's a very useful thing, again, coming from a world of Jung and mythology and all that. But I would say, yes, I think I would fall in the camp of the mythicist, but it's not something that keeps me up at night or something that I worry about. I mean, even tonight I was reading Chris Knowles' The Secret Sun Blogspot, And he has come out of the closet as a historicist. And I was like, okay, I guess he's made a stance and he's going to make his arguments. And I think that's great. But because as we exchange information, these things are very useful and these things change. I mean, at the conference, for example, Bart Ehrmer, of course, he's making a stand on Jesus being historical, but he certainly changed some things. He used to think that there was a tomb and Jesus was buried in the tomb. But as he's doing more research, he's like, no, if there was a historical Jesus, they probably took him out of the cross and tossed him in a pile with the other bodies and burned him. So again, these things change. And I think the more you look into things, the more there's very little man and there's more myth.
Yeah, Bart Ehrman is a interesting character in the mix because he's stripped away. I love when Christians put forth Bart Ehrman and they hold him up as, you know, see, Jesus really did exist. He was his historical figure. I'm like, that's the Jesus you want? You want Bart Ehrman's Jesus? I don't think you do. You better go read who he's leaving you with. And I don't think you want that, but.
Yeah, I mean, I might be sometimes I think I'm overcompensating because I'm like, hey, okay, if Jesus was this failed revolutionary guy, then what's the point? I mean, that's kind of pathetic. And even then, the problem is that Bart Ehrman's version of a historical Jesus is different than other scholars who see him as a stoic, as a wise philosopher, as a pacifist, as all these things. And so even there's like 1,000 versions of the historical Jesus.
Well, that gets back to maybe the original question or point I was trying to bring up is I love history. I love the way you approach it with bringing these top-notch scholars on to talk about these subjects. But I also feel like there's this question of does the history from the mystical, from the esoteric, you know, there is this tug back and forth. And then when we add to it that it is so fragmented, it's flawed, and it's just politicized beyond belief. We don't know how much we're being played by the history, except every time we find out, you know, oh, well, that was just a psyop, an ancient psyop that was played on us. So how do you struggle with that part of it?
I really don't. I mean, it seems that I've been tested. My gut on the Gnostics has been right. I mean, first of all, I think history is important. I mean, as the ancient Gnostics, reason is very important. The Greek philosophers believed in history. They were confident about it. And again, science and reason are very important. But as far as who the Gnostics were, it seems to be, I think my gut is right. I remember I had Joe Atwill for the second time, and he's going off, you know, the Romans invented Christianity, the Romans invented Jesus, da 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 da. I mean, you can't get a more radical mythicist than Atwill in 1,000 years, maybe a chariot, but they disagreed. And then I said, well, Joe, what about the Gnostics? Were they part of this conspiracy? Were they part of this brotherhood, this Roman machine to control the Jews and the world? And he turned around and, well, he didn't turn around. He answered on the microphone. He said, nope, the Gnostics were the rebels. They're the only ones who stood up to the machinery of this world. And I was like, okay, well, there you go. And that seems to be confirmed over and over by different scholars and guests. I mean, it seems unmistakable as of now that that's where the Gnostics were and that's their place in history. I don't think you could say they were part of a franchise or corporation or any sort of mainstream dispensation.
That's great. It's interesting to hear you say that, particularly about Atwill, because folks who have listened to Skeptico don't know this, but you are to blame for my many references to Atwill. And I think the importance of what he's done, I think he, as you were maybe alluding to, I think he takes it a little bit too far, but I think he changes the paradigm in just a fundamental way and saying, hey, clearly there's evidence for a psyop. So before we can go any further, we have to say, we have to keep asking ourselves, is that a psyop? Is that a psyop?
And exactly.
One of the things that did you say often on the show, and maybe you can elaborate on this, which would put you in a good seat to evaluate that, is you have often heard you say that, you know, the Gnostics were the first conspiracy theorists that we really know about. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, again, they were the first ones in history to stand up to the gods. I mean, that took quite a bit of cojones to do that, if you don't mind me saying that, and say these gods are false, or they're inferior, they're deficient. There has to be something beyond that. These gods and all their, I mean, in ancient times, the political machine, the temples were, you know, the great chain of being. There, it was all connected. So every, as above, so below. So all the structures of man, political structures were part of the gods, the priest and the prophet. So they were the ones who started producing this literature that seemed very paranoid, very existentialist, sometimes close to nihilistic, who basically said, no, 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 this is wrong. There has to be something else. There's something beyond this Old Testament God. There's something that started. We're going to work it out. We're going to go on our mystical flights. We're going to get information. We're going to write these texts as a form of self-therapy. We're going to make Jesus a theoretical Jesus, where our own personal Jesus, where we can find insights about ourselves. We're basically going to make the logos our own logos. And they started putting out this stuff that obviously freaked out the church fathers. It was unbelievable to the church fathers. It was unbelievable to a lot of the Greek, Greco-Roman philosophers like Plotinus. It would be later be very unbelievable to Muslim powers, Asian powers, Persian powers. So they were certainly the first conspiracy theorists, because they thought all of reality was one big machine to keep us down. I mean, every part of reality. And again, sometimes you have to look at the way people do myth. Myth can be very intense. I mean, when you read even beyond the Gnostic myths, it can be very rated R, it can be very gory, it can be very dark and everything else. But it's sort of a way of really hitting you in the face with these truths so you can see, again, the insights behind them. And that's what the Gnostics were doing. And when you look at them historically, they were always seen as very kind, very educated, very beloved by their communities for the most part. They were artistic. For example, the Cathars were beloved by the Catholic populations around them. Same with the Manichaeans. They walked a very good walk, a very kind Christian walk. In fact, some people, even in medieval times, you say the Cathars were really the true representatives of how a Christian should act and behave. But I think they came from the stance, and I always like to say with experience, is like when you're an alcoholic, the only way you're going to get better is if you finally stop and say, look, I have dug a hole. I am in a huge hole. I am in a terrible position. And that's going to be my default position every day of my life, because I want to fight for something. An alcoholic, he's fighting for sobriety, but the Gnostics were fighting for enlightenment, for spiritual clarity. And this is my default stance. This is where I'm going to draw the line. And of course, alcoholics have, again, every day is a problem. Every day is a terrible disease and a terrible fight, but they do find peace. They do find happiness. They are productive. I think in a spiritual way, that's what the Gnostics were saying. They were saying our default position is that things are really, really bad. If we don't stop saying things are really bad, if we drop our gaze, well, we're going to end up looking at our iPhones, or we're going to end up looking, you know, going playing ping pong or something like that, instead of doing this very important work.
That's an interesting, interesting point. And I want to return to that in a minute, but I'm going to kind of get there in a little bit of a roundabout way, because there's another guy that I've referenced a lot on Skeptico, and you're to blame for this guy too. And it's a biblical scholar and really religious scholar, Richard Smalley, who I should mention is also featured in the book Other Voices of Gnosticism that we've been talking about. Tell us a little bit about Smalley and why you think he's important, why he's included in the book. He's obviously a super smart guy, degrees from Harvard, Oxford, has done all sorts of different research, but tell us a little bit about him and why you included him in the book.
Well, obviously, for all the reasons you just mentioned, and it should be noted, yes, Richard is such an intelligent guy. I mean, he can go anywhere with his mind, but he is far from being, you might say, secular or an atheist. He is a very spiritual man. He's a theosophist. He's, I believe, a follower of Gurdjieff. I mean, he has been knee-deep in all these different spiritual practices, even the Course in Miracles he's embraced. Right. So he's traveled in all these spiritual paths. He's had experiences. And, of course, he's very much he's very interested in consciousness. If you read his book, The Dice Game of Shiva, that's a sort of a spiritual religious exploration of the concept of consciousness. So I think Richard becomes, you might say, a Renaissance man of the occult. But he's also very friendly to the Gnostics. He used to be one of the writers and editors of the famed Gnosis magazine that included Gary Lachman and David Feidler and all. So he's very friendly to the Gnostics, and he's very friendly to their trajectory or overall history from ancient times to today. So I think Richard has done great work, and he continues to do great work.
So here's the way that I think it weaves back into the question I wanted to ask about the point you were just raising. The show that you did with him, and it's a little bit different than the one that's in the book, but it just totally blew me away. His book on the history of God. Well, I can't do it justice to kind of recount his work, but two things that I took out of that I think are really important to me. One is he really draws a better picture of who this Yahweh character is, you know, and him being this thunder god that is appointed to look over Israel and somehow winds up as the God above God kind of thing, but really is kind of an accident. But the other thing that really kind of blew me away is his understanding of Satan. And he goes through the Old Testament and he says, wow, you know, here Yahweh is both good and bad. Now we have a little change in the scene and a little Zoroastrianism. And the next thing you know, we have this other character, Satan, and Satan is doing all the same things. The story's just being rewritten, and now we're putting Satan in the picture. So I think that launches us into another conversation about this reality and this veiled reality, and to what extent are we creating this reality? Because to just take that with a kind of simple-minded, I hate to pick on Richard Carrier, but I've had some run-ins with him, so I'm going to pick on him. But the simple-minded Richard Carrier, oh, then that means Satan isn't real. No, that doesn't mean Satan isn't real, because Satan pops up and sure as hell seems to be real, if you'll pardon the pun, but he's real in the same way that, you know, I talk to these near-death experience people and they experience Christ consciousness. Now they experience Jesus Christ, and Jesus Christ is there, and he takes their finger and puts him in the wound of their hand that was crucified. There is a spiritual reality to that from my point of view is undeniable. But it raises this huge question that I think is right with the cusp of what we're talking about, is this spiritual reality may be so different and layered in so many different ways that we can't really be sure when we say what's really real. In that other reality, Satan seems to be very real. Christ seems to be very real, whether he's historically real or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. I think a lot of it is, of course, a journey of discovery. I mean, how our consciousness evolves and how we explore these other realms, we are going to find things. And of course, human concept on how it goes, it's going to vary. It's going to change. Like you said, it used to be, well, this is Yahweh. He's in charge. Everything that happens is because of him. And then, of course, the theodicy comes in. Well, the nature of evil, how can a good God do that? And before you know it, yes, we have Satan and we have God, but that starts to branching out. Suddenly it's like, well, maybe it's just not Satan. Maybe there's other demons. We got Azazel. We got all these other demons, and they're different levels of malevolence or different levels of benign intentions. And the universe starts to get very crowded very quickly. And then, of course, these experiences, people start realizing, well, our ancestors, they're still around. They're still alive. They're still in other realms. I mean, when the Jews started, it was basically, it was a terrible universe. You had God who was basically immortal as long as he ate the fruit. But when humans died, that was it. It was over. It was a really terrible nihilistic universe. And they start realizing, well, maybe we're obviously having evidence that there is something after people die. So as human consciousness starts to develop and it starts to discover things, well, then we start realizing there's different models and people start to gravitate to these models. So I would say that, there's probably no doubt that there is evil spirits out there or evil entities, just as there are good ones. And there's different levels of them. And a lot of these things overlap. But it's still, again, it's still quite a journey. And we're still learning a lot.
But to what extent are we co-creating that reality, I guess, is my question, which is something that's come up again and again. And many, you know, wisdom traditions have said that. And the Gnostics, depending on how you read them, can be interpreted as saying the same thing, is that we're creating that reality. And then you did an awesome interview just a few months ago with Jeffrey Kripal, and he's picked up on that theme. And, you know, we need better sci-fi, and, you know, because we're and I think you pulled that back in a way that I thought was really effective. But it's the question still lingers out there, in that, are we looking at this whole idea of time being this linear kind of arrow moving forward? Is that the wrong way? Are we somehow co-creators of this reality? And what do you think about that personally from your journey? And then what do you lean on from your Gnostic friends for guidance on that question?
Well, first, how I lean on my Gnostic friends, again, there's the saying in the Gospel of Philip that I like to say a lot, that said, truth did not come into the world naked. It came in types and images. We cannot know the truth except through the types and images. So we're still stuck in a world of images, even if the great good comes up. I mean, there is a distortion in it. And also, I think you hit it on the nail. Unfortunately, as I talk about in our last show, for the most part, we are program robots, and you and I, we are sort of stuck in that linear Darwinistic model where everything has to move forward. Everything has, there's a reaction and an action. But as you see, the ancients, they had a much more holistic way of looking at things. And this is from, John Lundwall, who's done a lot of work in mythology and other guests, but people in oral societies had a completely view of reality. I mean, if they saw, for example, a bear, the bear was many things at once. It wasn't linear. The bear was a god. The bear was food. The bear was danger. The bear was love. The bear was an animal. The mind worked in a different way where they could immediately see everything. I wouldn't say connected in the New Age, but they definitely had a completely different experience where everything was, again, I want to say more cyclical, but it wasn't in this linear fashion where we're just sort of moving forward and discovering things at once. And it's very hard to see the world like that, because you and I, we see the world a certain way. The only way to get back is, again, to do some old fashioned shamanistic meditation regression and sort of try to find that worldview again. And that's, of course, part of the spirit. That's part of the spiritual work. I think people like Richard Smalley and others certainly practice it. And it does definitely have some benefits.
Then let me just approach that same topic from a slightly different angle. You know, I've been drawn for a long time, in some ways I don't even know why, to some of the non-dual teachers, especially folks from the yogic tradition. And I see some parallels with the Gnostic ideals that you're talking about. But I see some differences too, and I want to kind of explore those. I mean, first, to transcend the illusion is really what it's all about, and that everything is illusionary. But the difference, I think, the main one comes from this idea that we don't have to fight, and that as soon as we give up the fight, that's kind of when we move forward. There isn't that sense of agitation that in some ways I relate to, and I think a lot of people who are drawn to Gnosticism relate to, because we do seem to be engaged in this battle. But for the non-dual person, the quip I like is, you know, the spiritual path is easy for one with no preferences. If you really have no preferences, if you can really transcend this idea of good and bad playing out, of, you know, that we have to overcome something, then the illusion goes away that way too. Do you have any thoughts on that kind of more non-dual Buddhist yogic, you can get there from a number of different ways, kind of sensibility?
Yeah, it seems very attractive, but then I start wondering, maybe Joe Atwell will be in the background saying, that's part of the machinery trying to destroy you.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it sort of takes away the whole idea of human vitality, which is one of the great gifts we have, that passion to steal fire from the gods and use that fire to create and build better things. I mean, I don't know if I like that. I remember it was somebody I really like. I like to read Krishnamurti, and he would always, I love his work, and he would just start bitching about people in the East meditating because it said it made them as limp as asparagus. They lost, again, their human vitality, their elan vital. So that's what worries me about a lot of these practices, because, again, I don't want to be there. I know I'm a being of divine fire. I know I'm a creator. I'm a seeker. And I can't just sit there and just sort of melt away like a wallflower. So I would say that's where the Gnostics would disagree. Although the Gnostics were, again, about breaking out. They were an ecstatic movement, a very powerful ecstatic movement that believed in shamanistic, mystical, ecstatic experiences that could be very wild and crazy at times. So I think that's where the separation is. I mean, do you want to be, a human? To be a human being is to be a human being.
Okay, let's talk about another Gnostic-related topic, the simulation hypothesis, something that you mentioned early on, and it seems to be cropping up everywhere. Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, you hear him talking about it, famous astrophysicist, billionaire, entrepreneur, Elon Musk talking about it. Actually, I have to read this. This is a great quote from Elon, or it's a headline referring to the interest of these people like Elon Musk in the simulation experience. Here's the headline. Some of the world's richest and most powerful people are convinced that we're living in a computer simulation, and now they're trying to do something about it, investing billions or pouring money into efforts to break humans out of the simulation they believe that they're living in. Question. First off, you've already explained it, but recap why this is a Gnostic kind of idea in the first place.
Well, first of all, again, the Gnostics posited that reality was false. It wasn't some, really not a benign illusion or a playful illusion. It was, again, it was a synthetic matrix or machinery that kept us trapped. So that was their position. And,
literally or metaphorically, that's the part that I kind of get hung up on, because, and you're saying, yes, they meant literally, like archons are real, physically real, you really are trapped, you really can, not on some spiritual dimension, but on a physical dimension, or on both in some way?
I would say both. I mean, it's hard. I mean, I would say, yeah, literally we are trapped in an illusion. I think there's no doubt that's what they were saying. I mean, metaphorically is neither here nor there. I mean, again, is liberation is the goal. Your mental and spiritual liberation is the goal. Your body's lost. Your body is what it is. So, but I think it cracks me up that these people are just figuring out now. Of course, I have complete distrust. I think as author Sam Chris said, you know what they want? They already have enough power and wealth in this world. They want to hack into reality itself or get a trademark or break the, because the Gnostics wanted to break out, but also touch upon this great source, bring this wonderful information and wake up others. You know, people like Elon Musk, if he got his hands, if he got a hold of this code or anything, he would love to destroy it, because obviously the elite really are self-loathing haters when it comes down to it.
See, I have a different take on it. I think that, especially in the case of the Neil deGrasse Tyson and the people who just kind of listen to people like that, like Elon Musk, are missing the mark completely with this simulation hypothesis being this big computer cloud in the sky. It begs the question of simulation of what? I mean, these guys have kind of jumped from one dopey materialistic idea to another without really defining what they're simulating. What is consciousness? What is the divine spark, if you even want to get more spiritual about it? They've shelved that whole question and said, oh no, it's all reduced to computer circuitry. I think it really misses the point in a fundamental way that I think, to me, is different than what the Gnostics are talking about, because the Gnostics are always allegorical and metaphorical and literal, if you say they're literal too, which I guess they are too, but they're all those things at once because we are all those things at once. I mean, I don't think that's what, it that way.
No, I don't see any, again, there's no metaphysical orientation, which means something for the greater good or seeing it. They're just sort of jumping right there because they need something else to hack, or they've realized that they found a very cool narrative and they're going to exploit it or something like that. But
I think a lot of it has to do with just that the strictly materialistic paradigm is absurd and it isn't playing well. It isn't fitting with even some of the science. I mean, it hasn't fit with a lot of the science for a long time, but it's become more and more obvious. And I think they need another way to go. So, you know,
we both had Gordon White and how they've embraced panpsychism or whatever it's called. I mean, they realize they're in trouble. So they got to find something that works before the emperor has no clothes for sure forever.
Right. Let me try another one on you, kind of related in that vein. Demiurge equals deep state. Can we make that leap? Can we say beyond the spiritual realm of this thing that's playing out, this illusion that's playing out, this matrix that's being played out, it's also being played out in this geopolitical game that we're messed up with that is the deep state? Would you go that far? Or do you think when people try and stretch Gnosticism into some of these places that it doesn't belong, it kind of dilutes it down to just another meaningless kind of trick pony?
No, I think it works. I mean, I don't think you should just base it down to archons equals, you know, alien lizards who are controlling it. That stops the narrative. I mean, like you said, we are metaphysical, we are physical, but it's from a philosophical thrust, it's a very useful thing because after all, philosophically, it's that there are shadowy powers. That's what the Gnostic 2000 years that are controlling us. Behind these shadowy powers, there are probably bigger shadowy powers. And we need to find a way to discover them and expose them and hopefully disarm them through information. And it seems these days that's the only way you can get. I mean, that seems to be the big move today is to expose deep state and try to find out who are the people at the top who are pulling the strings. And I wouldn't be surprised. In fact, there's evidence that some of these players are very much into some strange occultism and probably have some dark spiritual powers behind them. It wouldn't surprise me at all.
That definitely seems to be what's happening. That's what's being played out.
That's where we're heading, Alex. I think that's the reality. The man behind the curtain.
Well, you know, and really, as we look back, can we really point to any time in history when that wasn't the case? I mean, you mentioned Chris Knowles, and I think that's the other path that he's going down, is saying, hey, every point in history we look back, we see the same kind of thing emerging. And I think this latest thing with the whole Pizzagate and the pedophile thing, you know, people are shocked. It's like, oh my God. It's like, well, just look back 20, 30 years with the Franklin scandal was the same damn thing. And I mean, it was on the Republican side. So if you're a Dem, go back there and study that and you'll feel good that it was at the highest levels of the Republican Party. And then, you know, I mean, look at Graham Hancock and, you know, here's one guy, the conquistador, and he's got an angel on his shoulder, a devil on his shoulder saying, go kill hundreds of thousands of people. That's your goal in life. And you got Montezuma, you know, is in direct contact with a spirit being that is just guiding him to this kind of psychopathic mass murder of people and this whole blood cult kind of thing. And I mean, there you go again. You know, you have two kind of psychopathic kind of spiritual entities that are kind of facing off. And I kind of look at that and I go, you know, this Pizzagate thing, really? You don't think this is, do you think this is really just kind of a new thing that's just happened in terms of these entities influencing these people in some very negative, dark ways?
This is like Moloch 2000 years ago. And as we go through history, like you said, this is coming up again and again and again. I mean, this is this is a darkness to keep humanity obedient and asleep and ignorant and subconsciously terrified. I mean, but now hopefully we've opened our eyes more and the toothpaste can't be put back in the bottle, barring from Gordon White again.
Let's hope. Miguel, tell folks more about what they're going to find when they visit your website, when they visit the website and buy Gnostic Radio. Obviously, the book they can find on Amazon. They're going to find it in e-form on there. Is there a printed edition of this?
Yes, there is. There is. Yeah, if you go to thegodabovegod.com, you'll see the book right there, all my other books, links to my books. You'll see a direct link to the podcast where you can download it or subscribe to iTunes or whatever you want. You'll see my blog with a lot of my essays on Gnosticism, print interviews. You'll see a whole lot of things, and hopefully that you can go on that journey of self-discovery. And these days, a lot of horror and a lot of opening your eyes, but hey, freedom, that's freedom, right? It's not easy. It's not fun. It's just, it's freedom.
It's vitality, right? That's what keeps
us
going. There
you go. Let's steal the fire from the gods or else they'll do bad things to us.
Awesome. Well, it's been awesome talking about this. Real quickly, any other projects going on that folks should know about or have a heads up about?
No, right now I just, the other voices of Gnosticism just came back. So I'm sort of just sitting back like you. I'm just trying to get one show a week out and get a little bit closer to the truth.
Awesome. Well, it's been fantastic having you on. Miguel, thanks again so much for joining me.
Thank you, Alex. Enjoyed it as always.
Thanks again to Miguel Connor for joining me today on Skeptico. One question I tee up from this interview is, do you think the Gnostic worldview is true beyond metaphor? So are there really argons out there? Is there really a demiurge? Or is this another abstraction of a reality which is beyond our understanding? Miguel obviously thinks the former, but what I'd really like to know is what you think. And the place to do that is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com, where you can join us on the forum or send me a message or just start a thread there in the comment section. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. I have a number of interesting shows coming up. I'm super excited about a couple of the guests that I'm interviewing. As you know, I don't mind having people on that I respectfully disagree with on some key issues. And I have some of those interviews coming up. So if you like it, stick around for that. If you don't like it, you might find yourself skipping a couple episodes. So be warned. So again, that's all for now. Thank you so, so much for joining me and for being a part of this Skeptico thing that we do. You are so much a part of it just by listening, just by adding your comments, just by spreading this information. And I sure appreciate your involvement. So until next time, take care and bye for now.